Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
Our final speaker for this session is Alan Grayson. Now, Alan describes himself as a paediatrician trapped in an adult intensivist body. So Alan looks after sick adults and children in Manchester. He also dabbles in medical education and the St. Emlyn's blog and quality and safety. And I was interested to read that he is someone who likes to, who's aiming to live off the grid and self-sufficiently. And I want to know whether the beehives have appeared out the back yet.
No.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you for coming to see us, and thank you to Nikki and David for being excellent and actually doing my talk. I've put a picture up of the Royal Manchester Children's Hospital, which is where I work for a day a week, because I'm quite proud to work there, but I am an imposter because I spend more of my time down at the Royal Infirmary, which is at the other end of the corridor, which is much less photogenic, and it's generally got somebody outside with a can of strong lager and a spliff. Usually at 9 o'clock in the morning. So it's nice to be with you lovely paediatric folk, and it's nice to be there. I'd like to start by asking you to consider what the three worst words in clinical practice are. So for David, being from Melbourne, it's probably coffee's run out.
Code brown.
That's a code brown. For anybody who's a paediatric consultant, it's probably registrar's off sick. If you're an emergency physician who dabbles in paediatrics, it's remember that child. And sometimes that's quite good, because we can use it to focus, and we can use it to reflect, and we can use it to develop things. For some strange reason, the slide prompter's not working. However, we can make it so much worse. We can make it so much worse by going, remember that child you saw. And if you go to the paediatric emergency department once a week, and your friends and colleagues who do paediatrics all the time start a conversation with you, you think, oh dear, I'm being referred to the GMC, I'm being struck off, I'm going to get sued, I'm going to have to go and see the coroner. Now, for all of those things, they are the worst things in the world. It's like going to see the head teacher, isn't it? And I would encourage you not to start a conversation with the trainee like that. It has happened to me. I was in a district general hospital not very far away from where I work, and I'd seen a child, and I thought I'd diagnosed tonsillitis, and I'd give the child some amoxicillin, quite advanced for 2005, because we didn't used to use amoxicillin, we used to use phenoxymethyl penicillin. But anyway, I gave the child some amoxicillin, safety netted the child, had a conversation with the nice middle-class parents and said, keep them drinking, give them some Calpol, give them the antibiotics, I'm sure it'll all be okay, but don't worry about coming back if there's a problem, because children sometimes deteriorate. So off I go home, have a glass of wine, have a decent night's sleep, rock up to work the next morning, remember that child you saw? Yep, came back with meningococcal septicemia. Oh, crap! And your world comes crashing down. And it takes a lot of time to build back up from that that point. And I'd like to, for the younger paediatricians in the audience, let's have a straw poll. Who has not sent home a child that's later come back with meningococcal sepsis, sepsis from other source, really, really quite poorly? Who hasn't done it? Hands up. So you're either really lucky or you haven't seen enough kids yet, because everybody has made that mistake. And for the younger paediatricians in the audience, be kind to yourselves. You will make that mistake and it will go horribly wrong once or twice. And why? Why? Because kids are complicated. We see 100 children at least a day in the paediatric emergency department in the winter. And they all come in looking a bit like this. Got a bit of a snotty nose, they've got a bit of a temperature, they're off the food, they're off the fluids, and they don't want to be there, and they don't want to do anything at all. And for every 100 of these, about 5 will come back with something really wrong. Not purpura fulminans, such as this child, but they'll come back with something wrong with them. And it's really, really difficult. And it's really, really difficult to get it right because the overlap of symptomatology between the child with the bad virus and the child with the serious bacterial infection is quite huge. So be kind to yourselves. Because diagnosing sepsis in kids is hard. I'm a fake paediatrician. I'm not here to tell you how to do it. I'm just here to try and share some war stories with you all, which is what we do at conferences. But everything that David has talked about in the high-yield respiratory exam could be put in this talk. Everything that Nikki has talked about in the high-yield exam for dehydration is relevant to this. It's building it up, and it's building it up. Diagnosing sepsis in kids is hard, but we don't make it easy for ourselves. In Britain, and I think you've just adopted it recently in Australia, we have the four-hour target. So as an emergency physician, the government have generously given me 4 hours to see, assess, treat, and discharge or admit every single patient that comes through my emergency department. That's quite an ask. Sometimes we have a two-hour wait for triage in RMCH. Don't tweet that, please, because I'll get into trouble. but I suspect during virus season and when Coronation Street, so for those of you who aren't from the United Kingdom, Coronation Street is a soap opera about everyday working people in the north of England, which is really, really popular, and people time their emergency department visits to not coincide with Coronation Street or to coincide with Coronation Street, sometimes we get really, really rather busy. In fact, we have three peaks. We have the after-school peak, we have the around Coronation Street peak, and we have the 11 o'clock just as Alan wants to go home from his shift peak. So we have the four-hour target, and that makes it difficult. And we also have the fact that very nice paramedics and very nice parents give their children paracetamol and ibuprofen to try and bring down their fever. Not because the child is uncomfortable or because the child is sore. It's because a fever is a bad thing and we must treat it, mustn't we? Fever must be treated. Never mind that this is a biological, evolutionary thing that we've developed over thousands and millions of years to try and defeat bacteria. No, we must treat the fever. So you've got a child that doesn't have a temperature. And it's really easy to spot an unwell-looking child when they've got a temperature of 39.5 and altered vital signs. And the other problem that we've got is the fact that we've got the paediatric early warning scoring system, which is really, really rather sensitive, but really poorly specific. So it will pick up, if you've got a child whose pew's orange or red, they will likely be quite poorly, or it will pick up, because it's highly sensitive, it will pick up all the children who are quite poorly. However, it won't tell you that they are that poorly and what's wrong with them. True story, our paediatric intensivists in Manchester wanted, after we'd adopted pews, they wanted to be told about every child who was pews red. There's a mouth open here at the front. That lasted less than a day. So we're talking about 100 plus children in virus season in the winter. 50 of them come through the emergency department and their pew's red. So, hi, is that paediatric intensive care? Yeah, we've got another one for you. My goodness, the consultants weren't particularly happy. So we make it difficult. So for all those 100 children, we need to do something with them. And unfortunately, our paediatric services can't cope. So I can't refer every sick-looking child to the paediatricians, because that's 100 a day and you don't have the resources to deal with that. I cannot give all of those 100 children antibiotics. I certainly can't give them all intravenous antibiotics because we have a duty to steward our antibiotics for future generations. So how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? So Nikki and David have told you about dehydration and respiratory examination. And I would encourage you that when you are assessing the sick child, you do your best textbook, Royal College membership, OSCE examination. You do it like in the book. You're the nicest, most competent doctor ever, and you do it for every single child. Oops. There we go. First, a bit about triage. It's quite stressful standing up here in front of all you lot. So sorry for getting my train of thought. It's nice to see friendly faces. Emergency medicine be throwing things at you right about now. So first, a bit about triage. It's a nice appropriate picture of the First World War. And First World War and coffee beans is where the triage came from. And David alluded to it in his talk. So the nursing staff do much more paediatrics than I do, and they have much more experience than I have. I do a day a week. I'm a fraud. I'm a fake. The nurses are there for 37 and a half hours a week. And if they come to see me and tell me a child is sick, I would be a fool not to listen. So for those of you who are at an F2, PGY2, PGY3 level, and the nurses bypass you and go to the registrar, don't feel upset. Really don't feel upset. The nurses are just worried, and you will get your time in the sun. And if you're the CT3, ST4, and the nurses bypass you and come to me, don't feel upset. It just means that they're really worried about this child. And again, you will get that. And a marker of success as a paediatric emergency physician is when the nurses go, got a poorly one for you, Alan. Come on, come and see this one. And then you know you've made it because the nurses trust you. So it's about building up your index of suspicion. So if the nurses come and grab you, or the nurses bring the patient ahead in the emergency department, then that's a sign that you should be worried. The next thing is talking to the patient. So in Manchester, what seems to happen if a child is poorly, that the entirety of the family comes to the emergency department. So they're booking one child in, who's Manchester triage orange with paediatric early warning score red, but the other two kids who've just got a bit of a cough and a cold and are quite well, oh, we just wanted to get them checked out as well. I used to get really annoyed about that. And then I realised what the patient population was, because I work in inner city Manchester, which is kind of like any other inner city emergency department. We have two patient populations. We have the rather nice middle class Guardian reading hummus eating population. True story, there's a little boy who's allergic to chickpeas. He's not going to go down very well in Charlton. And then we have the other population, which is we have a lot of people who have come to Manchester to make it the wonderful, diverse, brilliant place that it is. And if you've got a child with a fever of 40 degrees and you come from sub-Saharan Africa and they've got viral upper respiratory tract symptoms, it is most likely cold because they're in Manchester, but the parents don't know that because they think it's malaria and they're worried. So talk to the entirety of the family, because mum here might give you the best history, and she'll be able to tell you about vaccinations, and she'll be able to tell you about how long the child's been poorly for. And I quite like to ask the question, so when was little Tommy, or little Nevaeh, as you've got here, last well? And what are they normally like to get a baseline? However, Nevaeh's older sibling, Mount Wellington bus stop, just for Ross Fisher, if he's in the audience, might be able to tell you a little bit more, because mum might have missed Nevaeh's febrile convulsion, but sibling might have seen sister doing a funny little shaking thing. Also, it just makes the family feel valued, and it makes them feel like you're appreciating them being there and they're not wasting your time. And kids get really, really bored very, very easily in the emergency department. So take your history. Look for clues. Try and piece it together. Do your textbook examination. There will be, once the slide clicker works on, I think we're running out of batteries, there will be a picture. Hey, there you go. Of an examination. Do your best textbook examination. I find it a right pain in the bum. I like to see patients. I really like to see patients. I have a bit of a competition with Simon Carley, my colleague, who is speaking later on, because the only thing that counts for emergency physicians is both quality of care, them not coming back, and how many numbers you actually put through the books. It's piecework. So do it. Do it well. Write it down. That's the big pain in the bum. Once we get the EPR, we can do macros and it'll all be better. I even bought my own otoscope because I was so upset at spending so much time looking for one. Common problem everywhere? Yeah. So £10 from a well-known auction site got me a lovely purple otoscope, which is in my bag. And it was the best decision I ever made because it allows me to see two more patients a shift, which is really important. So examine the child, get your stethoscope out, look, know what is normal and know what is abnormal. Have a look in the ears, because you look like a fool when you refer somebody to the paediatricians with sepsis of unknown source. They come and they go, yeah, bulging drum, mate, amoxicillin, home. We have a badge of honour in our emergency department, our paediatric emergency department in Manchester. You are not a proper paediatric emergency physician in Manchester until a child has vomited McDonald's milkshake over you. And McDonald's milkshake is very, very important as well, because it forms part of the Rachel Jenner test. Rachel Jenner is one of my paediatric emergency physician colleagues. A child drinking a McDonald's strawberry milkshake does not need admission to an acute paediatric bed. You can have that one for free. That's your take-home point. So until you've been vommed on, you are not a proper emergency physician, so always keep a spare change of clothes in your locker. So what you're trying to do, pretty picture of a bird, what you're trying to do is work out what's normal and what's abnormal. Sometimes the abnormality is clear, like this jackdaw's beak. However, sometimes the changes are subtle. And what you're doing is you're assembling a puzzle about what the child is normally like to what the child is like now. And our job as paediatric emergency physicians or anybody who works with acute paediatricians is to get to that tipping point where you decide that this child is more likely than not to have a serious bacterial infection and they need intravenous antibiotics and potentially fluid resuscitation and admission to a paediatric bed or paediatric intensive care. It is not our job to overtly question whether it is the right thing to do. It's about having that doubt and sharing that doubt and putting it all together in your brain and doing what you think the right thing is. So, we talked about 100 kids a day. About 20 of those go to somewhere called our Paediatric Clinical Decision Unit. Of those, 10 will go to the acute paediatricians for inpatient admission and IV antibiotics, and 10 will go home, likely with oral antibiotics. Some things terrify me. I'm a big, scary Yorkshireman. I usually have no hair, but I let it grow out a little bit. Some things terrify me. These things terrify me. These things are really scary. When you're not an acute paediatrician, small people are really, really difficult, especially when they haven't even been born yet, technically. The other things that really terrify me are the ones that you, the clever paediatrician types, keep alive for ages and ages with complex diseases that I don't even understand and I can't even say the names of. So for those, I reach out to you and I want your help, because these are the ones that deteriorate really, really quickly. These are the ones that end up in intensive care, and these are the ones that cause problems. Just looking at the clock, I better speed up a little bit because you all want tea. So what about investigations? I've got plenty of time, so I can bore for hours then. Excellent. So what about investigations? I think you're all probably paid up members of the Children and Not Little Adults Club, aren't you? And for me, I'm a little bit worried about the adultification of paediatrics. I'm not a proper paediatrician, but I'm a bit worried about the adultification of paediatrics. So when I did my paediatric training, which was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, we never bled children. We never bled children. And over the last few years, I've seen a culture where we're bleeding more and more children. Ah, bit about time. See, again, stress, sweat pouring down my back, worried about you lot, talk about time. We'll come back to blood tests. That's the next slide. We'll talk about time. I think it was Damien Rowland said it. Damien said it, that observation is an investigation in paediatric medicine. Kids take time to declare themselves. We have a paediatric clinical decision unit that is attached to our paediatric emergency department, and we share it with the paediatricians. And it is there where we put the kids who've got the head injury that need an overnight stay rather than having a CT scan, and it's also there where we put the kids where we're not sure what to do with. Our average length of stay there is 6 hours. So that's 6 hours for the amitop to work, the blood test results to come back. That's 6 hours for the kids to have a pee. And that's 6 hours for the nice middle-class mums and dads from Didsbury to have their hummus and also realise that when I say to them, or when the registrar says to them, then I go and confirm that little Johnny, or Loki, the best one yet, little Loki has a viral upper respiratory tract infection. They're that bored and they're that reassured by the time that they've spent in the paediatric clinical decision unit that they're then prepared to go home. So going back to the adultification of paediatric medicine, I'm really quite concerned about the number of blood tests that we seem to do. We seem to bleed a lot more kids than I think is necessary. And I think we probably underestimate the effect that that has on some children. So We recently had a bit of an incident in our emergency department. Well, no, not our emergency department, our dental hospital, where there was a little bit of a sterilising problem. Again, please don't tweet this out because I'll get into trouble. A little bit of a problem with sterilising, and there were some kids who had procedures where there were improperly sterilised instruments. It was absolutely fine. There was absolutely minimal risk of bloodborne virus infection, and we've actually got to the end of that process, and nobody's got AIDS. Yay! However, we had a 15-year-old who was the same size as me. He played rugby union. And that 15-year-old, because of a formative experience where he had been held down, had blood taken from him, did not want to have his vaccination and did not want to have his blood taken for BBV investigations. So I think we probably underestimate the harm that we're doing to kids by bleeding them. And I would ask you to put your Bayesian evidence-based medicine hat on. What do you do with those test results? So a common test that we do is CRP, isn't it? So you've got a child who you've possibly got an infection, you do a CRP. Yeah? So what do you do if the CRP is normal? Does that change your management? When do you treat? When do you suspect that there's a serious bacterial infection going on? Sure, it's dead easy when the CRP is 300. That's dead easy. Still doesn't tell you where it is, does it? But so when do you treat? 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100? What's your cutoff point? Or are you just using it as part of your gestalt? And if you think this kid's fairly sick and the CRP is 50, then you're giving him IV antibiotics. And what's the performance of CRP? What's the performance of CRP in diagnosing serious bacterial infection? Any guesses? Sensitivity, roughly? 75%. So it's going to miss a fair few. Specificity, again, is about 75%. So you're going to be over-treating a few as well. So we can say, or I can say, the CRP is a fairly crap test. The slide that's got a red E in the middle, but it's not coming up. And how about... There you go. That's the only bit of profanity that I'm allowed. I got told that I wasn't allowed to swear. I'm an emergency physician. I have fairly industrial language. So that's the only bit of swearing in here. That's my one indulgence. So what about these bad boys? What do you do with a neutrophilia? At what point does a neutrophilia tell you that you've got a serious bacterial infection? Neutrophils go up for all sorts of reasons. All sorts of inflammatory processes cause a rise in white cell count. So where's your cutoff for that as well? And this isn't telling you to not bleed children. It really isn't. It's just to have a thought about why you're bleeding the child and what you're going to do with that result, which is, after all, the principles of evidence-based medicine. A little nod to the Sprout study. Don't know if there's any investigation of the Sprout study in there, but this is one of the best papers I've read about paediatric sepsis. It was a point prevalence study over 5 days in paediatric intensive care units worldwide, because, sadly, for a profession that relies heavily on evidence, there is precious little evidence about paediatric sepsis, and certainly not as much for what is the biggest killer of children worldwide. So I'll tweet out the paper later on. Katie might be able to find it and tweet it out for me. But the Sprout study was really revelatory because it told us what was going on in our paediatric intensive care units. So 40% of the kids there have got respiratory illnesses. 20-odd have got serious bacterial infections, serious bacteremias. There was about equivalence between gram-positive and negative. And the most surprising thing for me when I read it, and I think I need to change my practice because of it, is that 13%, 1 in 8 children, had a serious invasive fungemia. And I never think about treating children who are poorly. You know, they get... Ceftriaxone, they might get tazosin, but they never ever get treatment for fungi. That's something I need to change. So I need to wrap it up because I've got 15 seconds on the second countdown timer. So wrapping this up, what do I want you to do? What would I like you to take from this? So for the people who are just taking their baby steps as paediatricians, you will make mistakes, and diagnosing sepsis in children is hard. This is not to minimise that. If you've got any concerns, go and talk to a more grown-up doctor. We will not bite. Trust me, we would rather be mithered, which is a good Mancunian word for being bothered, than have to deal with the serious untoward incident review down the line. For the grown-ups, remember the mistakes that you've made and try and prevent your trainees from making them too. And when it goes wrong, be kind and don't say, remember that patient you saw in the middle of the shop floor. The time to have that feedback discussion is not on the shop floor, not in your office. It's probably in a coffee shop 2 or 3 days down the line, which is neutral territory and it's safe. And for all of us, I think we need to be kinder to ourselves. And I think we need to commit as a group, as we have done as a conference, to getting more involved with finding out what the evidence is for the treatment of paediatric sepsis and advancing care worldwide, both for our higher income countries and for also the low and middle income countries that depend on us as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Alan. Really great talk and certainly highlighting the difficulties of diagnosing sepsis in children. Comments or questions from the floor?
Thank you so much. I'm Richard Burridge from consultant paediatrician from Watford. I just wondered whether you've had similar experiences with talking about your adultification of children and blood tests, whether you feel that the NICE sepsis guidance goes a long way to kind of create that atmosphere where there's an impression that investigation and treatment is a high priority. Certainly our local sort of audits have shown that 25-30% of non-injured children coming through the department will trigger as red flags on sepsis, for which the guidance is a septic screen and antibiotics. Clearly there's meant to be some thinking in there, but for the lowest common denominator, risk averse, fear of medical legal, etc., are you finding that that's a factor?
I completely agree with you. I think the NICE guidelines have to be written as the lowest common denominator, and they have to be safe, and they have to cover all eventualities. Unfortunately, this is a common debate we have in emergency medicine. Not every unwell child in a paediatric emergency department will see a paediatric emergency physician or a consultant paediatrician or a consultant emergency physician. So the guidelines are written to be as safe as they possibly can. So they're hugely sensitive but not particularly specific. And the problem is, once you start doing investigations, then you have to deal with the results of those. And that's part of the problem. And it's hard. It's really hard. I wouldn't want to write guidelines. But equally, I don't want to work all the hours that God sends, and I'd like to see my family as well, as I suspect you do. And it would be ideal, but we are in a fairly resource-poor environment in the NHS. And until we can get consultants involved in every child's care in the emergency department, then we've got a long way to go.
I'm coming over here to Katie, because I think people have commented on Twitter.
Thanks very much. So I have a question from Twitter handle, Tired Kiwi Nurse. How can nurses convince certain medical staff to come and see a patient if they're worried about sepsis? What do you want to hear?
What do I want to hear? My name's Alan. If you call me Dr. Grayson, it's either the GMC or the bank calling. That's not good. So it's about having that flattened hierarchy and being able to trust your nurses enough. I mean, can we have some context from that tired Kiwi nurse? Where are you? Hi. Okay. I don't disagree. So for those on the floor, some doctors are better at coming to see the patients the nurses are worried about than others. And that's probably you lot, which is why we're here, because we want to be the best doctors and nurses that we can be. How you do it is you just tell them. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm worried about this kid, come and see them. And if you have to drag me by the ear and say, you need to come and look at this kid, then do that. Because at the end of the day, your role as a nurse, and I'm fairly sure it's the same in NZ as it is in the UK, your role primarily is as a patient's advocate. And if that doctor isn't doing what you want them to do, so if you go to the F2, the PGY2, and they don't come, go and get the registrar. And if you don't get the registrar, come and get me. And if you can't get me as a paediatric emergency physician, get Richard as a consultant paediatrician. Because at some point, somebody will answer that call that you need. And then we can work out why they didn't down the line. And the problem is the people who don't come when you ask. Too busy should not be in a doctor's vocabulary, especially if you're worried about the patient.
Yeah,
Another question from Claire Salter. So we all have biases from bad experiences, for example, doing a chest x-ray in all kids after recent missed effusion. How do you reset that balance so you don't do harm by over-investigating?
That's a difficult one. Well, we all have biases, but we need to understand why we have those biases. So I think over-investigation after you've missed something is entirely normal. When something goes wrong with kids, I basically you admit everybody, don't you? You know, you miss a paediatric sepsis, they come back, they bounce back on you, everybody's getting admitted. You know, you miss a fracture, everybody's going to fracture clinic. And that's normal practice. And the only thing that stops that is time and reflection. And those are our best tools. And your paediatricians, you are some of the most reflective doctors in practice. Surgeons don't reflect unless something goes wrong. They really don't. Emergency physicians reflect because things go wrong. You reflect because things go right. And what you're trying to do is celebrate the good stuff that you've done. So keep on doing that.
One more from Laura Hall. Is there any evidence for calcitonin in children?
See, I didn't go down the calcitonin, the precepsin, the procalcitonin, the precepsin route. I think that in about 15 years' time, we will probably all be doing pro-CT and precepsin in our children. But whilst it still costs a vast amount of money, only if you're in a really rich health economy will you be doing it. I suspect it will prove to be, and the data that I read when preparing for this talk was quite limited, but it outperforms, but only just CRP in the diagnosis of serious bacterial infection in children. But I think that there needs to be more evidence, and I think that what we need to be doing is not taking the data from adult sepsis and applying it to children. And that's a very, very dangerous route to go down, because kids are not little adults, and the disease spectrum is very, very different between kids and adults.
Okay, any last questions from the floor? I know we're a little bit early, but the room's very crowded and everyone looks very hot. So if there's no other burning questions, I'll call the session to a close and everyone gets to go and have lunch.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!